Welcome back to the FKT podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Fastest Known Time now has updated FKT guidelines regarding para athletes. Athletes who have any eligible impairment listed by the International Paralympic Committee may submit an FKT by checking the para athlete checkbox on the FKT submission form. For the purposes of an FKT, para athletes may self-certify and do not need to have formal evaluation of their impairment. Para athletes also do not need to improve on existing FKTs by non-para athletes, nor do they need to submit evidence of their impairment. However, they should state in their trip report which of the 10 IPC impairment types they have. Because of the varied degree of impairment within each type, our FKT editors will not compare times between para FKT submissions, even within the same impairment type. Generally, any para FKT submission will be accepted if it meets all other verification guidelines. On today's episode, I'm joined by our first para athlete, Shawn Cheshire. She shares her experience setting the first blind, unsupported FKT crossing of the Grand Canyon, going north to south in 10 hours and 58 minutes. Thank you, Shawn, so much for coming on the show today. I'm really excited to chat with you.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about this.
First of all, I'd love it if you could talk about the FKT route you did and describe things like the direction of travel and time of year and what the route itself is actually like.
So I did a solo crossing of the Grand Canyon rim to rim without a sighted guide because I'm totally blind. So it was just me, my hiking poles, and my backpack. I started from the North Rim about 4 o'clock in the morning on May 23rd, 2024, and hiked all the way across the canyon up the South Kaibab Trail and about 23-ish miles in 10 hours and 58 minutes.
When I was doing my research, it appears that this was not your first Grand Canyon crossing. It looked like in 2018, you did another crossing of the Grand Canyon in a little bit of a different fashion. So could you talk about what that previous crossing was like, as well as what your motivation was to attempt this particular FKT in 2024?
Of course. In 2018, at that time, I was still racing for Team USA on their paracycling team, racing a tandem bike, and I sustained a concussion. And so I'm kind of that person that really needs to have goals and things to work towards. It just really helps my mental health. And I've never really hiked before as a blind person. I lost my vision when I was 36. And so we did some research and we figured out that there has never been a blind woman that had done the double crossing of the Grand Canyon, the rim to rim to rim. And so that summer, we made a plan, and October 8th of 2018, myself and three sighted guides, we did the double crossing of the Grand Canyon, the 42 miles in 24 hours and 15 minutes. And at that time, the only record we could find of the blind guys that have done the Grand Canyon, they finished at 28 hours. So we're really excited that we beat that time. And so then you just kind of fast forward, and I retired from Team USA and just started doing these adventures of challenging the social ideas of what blind people can and can't do. And one of the things, so I went and attempted to climb Mount Everest in 2023 and ended up with severe ear damage.
Oh, no.
I just had total reconstruct. I'm actually partially deaf now because of that.
Oh my gosh.
I know. It was awful. I was trying to be the first blind woman to summit.
Was it from the altitude or?
They think I was susceptible to it just because of my brain injury already. So, and I didn't know. And I was so bummed because I couldn't get past the ice falls. The higher I went, the more painful it was. By the time I got home, I was almost deaf. So the year and a half following Everest, it was really about recovery and trying to figure out about, okay, what do I do now? And when you have hearing loss on top of being total blind, I'm complete total blind, it's really changes a lot of things again. And a friend of mine, he's a professor at NAU here in Flagstaff, went to a conference in Italy, maybe, and he met Reinhold Messner, who is a famous climber. And they were talking about blind people and summiting Everest. And this was just before I went to Everest. And he made a statement to Scott and his wife that blind people will always be tourists because we always need a guide. And so we'll never truly be adventurers or climbers. And I was like, why would you say something like that?
Yeah, that's terrible.
So I was like, all right, Sean, like, what can you do to just bunk that notion? And, you know, ever since I did that double crossing of the Grand Canyon, it's just a really special place for me. And I thought, okay, so I'm familiar with the canyon. I don't know, Sean, do you think you could do it? And I didn't know that I could do it without a guide and find my way across and not die. And I think the thought of it really was terrifying to me. And I'd wanted to try. I wanted to try to see if I could do it. And so that's kind of how that idea of doing it without a sighted guide came up.
And just to be clear for our audience, you did not have a guide. You also didn't have a service animal. You were completely by yourself.
My guide dog was not with me. He actually does not like the Grand Canyon. I think he's afraid of heights because I don't think he likes that overlook.
Right.
He just cries when you take him there.
Oh.
Yeah. Because trust me, that was my first thought, was doing it with my dog because he's a great trail dog. But the one time I tried it, he cried the whole time. And I was like, I can't torture my dog. So I was like, all right, he's not in. Yeah. So I had two people on the trail way behind me. And the agreement was no contact. And because I'm blind and I follow sound, I can't hear you at all. You have to know, you can't talk to me. You can't be close enough that I hear you. This has to be 100% on my own. And the agreement was the only time that they would ever make contact is if I was hanging for my life, like I slipped and was hanging on a ledge or something, I was going to die. So death was the only reason they could interact with me. And so they followed at a distance the whole hike.
Okay. So I think the obvious question is definitely going to be about navigation, like how you navigate the Grand Canyon. And specifically, I was finishing my Arizona trail hike a week or so before you went through. And I remember as I was getting up to the North Rim, there was a bunch of significant trail damage. There were a big pile of jumbled rocks and dirt, and there was just stuff in the trail that I had to climb over. So, you know, how do you navigate the Grand Canyon without sight, without a guide? How do you find your way when there's an obstacle like this that, like, all of a sudden you're like, wait, am I on the trail or am I wandering off the trail right now? You know, because it's on a switchback. So I would imagine that feels similar to walking off the trail. Can you just tell us about what that's like? What went into that?
Yeah, of course. So I think a big difference with me with the lack of having visual feedback is I'm very present in my feet. And I'm using the feels and the sounds of the canyon of, like, you can tell when there's a rock wall on one side and a drop off on the other. And with the switchbacks, when you, maybe the next time you're on a trail, when you're coming into a switchback and the trail's going to, let's just say, bend to the left, that when you're coming up to the turn, there's a slight drop in the left foot. As you come into the turn, then it becomes more significant, more significant. And I'm always using my two hiking poles. With the Grand Canyon, I'm kind of fortunate because most of the space there's some sort of an outline to the trail. So I'm feeling my way around that and trying to stay away from the edge. And it's interesting you say that about the rockfall, because I remember that when I got to the point of the rockfall on the North Rim, I was like, I literally have no idea what happened to the trail. Like, did I take a wrong turn? I had to retrace my steps back a little bit, but it was very clear I was on the trail and then there was nothing. But really what helped me was ahead of me, I could hear two voices and I was like, oh, they're on my level. So they got over there somehow. So there's got to be a way over this. And so what I did was, is I used my cane and tried to stay as close to the inside away from the edge as possible. And just, like, not pounded down with my cane, but I used a little bit more force than just hiking just to see if it was stable. And then just slowly crawled over it to get to the other side. And then I found the trail. And I think what was shocking is I didn't with the, as many times as I've done the Grand Canyon, I didn't remember there being such narrow areas. And those areas, if you're thinking about it, I'm hiking and, you know, right pole, left pole, right pole, left pole. I always have to keep my weight shifted to the inside of the trail, because every now and then when it gets narrow, that left pole or right pole, depending on which side, there's nothing there, right? And you just, it's like you're catching air with the pole. And so if my weight was shifted to that side, I'd fall. I'd slip down. So one of the things I had to constantly think about was like always keeping my weight, no matter what, shifted to the inside. So if I caught air on that pole, that I wasn't falling off the trail that way. Yeah, it was just this constant like mental focus, paying attention to how my feet feel when I'm stepping on, what my poles are touching, the sounds, the feels. And every now and then there are areas where the trail's not really close to anything. Like there's not a rock wall on one side and a drop off. And so I had this little JBL speaker that I would just turn on and just play some music lightly. And it gave me just enough echolocation to kind of understand where I was in the canyon. And so, and that was helpful for me as well. I must have had like 97 adrenaline rushes going down the North Rim, of heart racing, like, oh shit, that was so close. just terror. Like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. What was I thinking? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's fascinating to me when you're talking about the echolocation, because I've hiked across the Grand Canyon many times and I'm frequently surprised at the way sound echoes in there. You can hear the roaring spring and things like that. And it sounds like it's on your left, even though, you know, it's on your right. So the canyon itself seems like it would represent a lot of challenge with using auditory feedback.
Oh, yes. I think that I would say that the most that I relied on were my feet. What I felt under my feet and using my hiking poles, because I did a lot of poking in front of me. So when you go across the bottom, they've got all of those really tall rocks for the water. So if it gets heavy rain, instead of letting it rush down, it diverts it off of the trail. And those will hit your... So obviously I've tripped over them and bashed my shins in, but those, man, those will take you out. If you're moving at a good clip and you don't see them, you just go, it, you know, run right into it. So I'm constantly flicking one of my poles out in front of me, you know, just to make sure like that, even that was, I was clear of that. A lot of people asked me on the trail when they realized I couldn't see, they were like, God, how in the world are you doing this? Like, we can see, and we're like tripping and twisting our ankles and whatever. And they're like, how are you doing this? And I'm like, well, just like you, I'm twisting my ankles, I'm bashing my toes, and I'm taking it one step at a time.
Yeah, that's all you can do. Yeah, that actually brings up another question I had. The Grand Canyon's a busy place. I've definitely met some fairly rude trail users out there who don't want to yield trail. Did you how do you deal with encountering other people, like letting them know, hey, I can't see you, especially if they're being quiet, they're not making noise or whatever. How does that play out, or how did it play out?
Oh, well, hopefully this doesn't make me look bad. You know, I love it when people are curious. I love it when they're curious and they ask questions, because I'd rather someone ask me anything than just to assume. And so those interactions to me are positive. And then you have people that just, they don't care. I've got a huge fluorescent blind sign on the front. I've got a huge fluorescent blind sign on my backpack on the back. I've got a white cane hanging from my belt, because I always have a white cane with me. And if I can hear someone approaching me, I'll announce myself, blind hiker holding my line, or something like that is what I'll announce. But sometimes it just doesn't matter. They'll just barrel right into you with this expectation that you're going to move. And it gets frustrating. And I have to try really hard to not let it go past frustration into being angry. Wow. But I think that when you're physically struck, when you're mentally and emotionally and physically tired and climbing out of the South Rim, let me just tell you what, I encounter every person that does not know climbing etiquette. Like the yield to the person climbing up, nobody's paying attention. One of the things that I've learned being in the canyon is that if I have someone ahead of me and they announce to hikers coming down, there's a blind hiker behind me, please watch out for her, they move around me. But me alone as a blind hiker, just with a sign on me, the front and back, and trying to announce myself, they don't care or they're not aware, or I can't tell you how many times I've been knocked down because of people that just, they don't want to move, or they think I should move, or they're not paying attention, or they're not listening. And they literally will just ram into me from a shoulder and I twist and fall and they just keep going. They don't even stop to be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Are you okay? So to me, that's disappointing because I can't imagine ever knocking someone down and not being like, oh, I'm so sorry. Let me help you up and my bad. I don't know.
That's shocking to me. I mean, I guess I have seen a lot of inconsiderate people on trail. Shocking to me that, especially like if you are wearing a sign and you're announcing yourself, why anyone would not give you consideration. You know, that's just very upsetting and disappointing. So the other aspect of the navigation besides the actual trail itself and the people that you're encountering are junctions. There are actually quite a few junctions crossing the Grand Canyon to campgrounds, to Ribbon Falls, to the Wright Angel Trail. How are you navigating junctions? Do you just have them memorized? How are you knowing which way to go?
So the only junction that I'm aware of, and I'm kind of thankful nobody else pointed any of the other junctions out to me because that probably would have made it challenging, is the route that I take through Phantom Ranch. And I've never hiked through Phantom Ranch up Wright Angel alone before. I don't know. I think even right now with having hiked down the South Kaibab and up Wright Angel, I'm unfamiliar with it, how I could get to the Wright Angel Trail without a guide. I mean, I'm an explorer, so I would try to figure it out or maybe ask someone. So I know how to get through Phantom Ranch and what to listen for and to follow to get through that and then to the bridge and up the South Kaibab. So other than this other path in Phantom Ranch, I'm unaware of other junctions, which is good. But that's good for me because that meant I wasn't going to get confused.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they're less obvious when you're going north to south. Because most of the time I've crossed the canyon, I'm going south to north. But yeah, the Phantom Ranch would be the most confusing one.
My recollection is the Ribbon Falls, if you're going north to south, is on the right. And I always stay on the inside of the trail, which I think is why I don't ever know where that is. Because if I was on the right side, trailing that right side, I'd probably end up going down the Ribbon Falls trail. But I stayed to the left on the inside and just kept following the trail past that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess another question, encountering mules.
So when I did that crossing in May, I did not encounter mules. I did the crossing again in October, on October 5th alone. I did it another solo and left earlier in the morning. And it was still just so hot on the South Rim. It was unbelievable. We actually encountered mules. But the first time I did it, I did not encounter that. But I would have heard them and I would have just found a place off of the trail.
I think that the mules generally want to take the inside line as well. So I was just wondering how that worked out.
Well, you know what? I really have to go into that with the mentality of if, and I thought about this, I'm going to hold the inside. Now, if they want to stop the mules and yell at me and I can explain to them I'm blind, I'm not going to the edge. So what do you want to do now? I'm prepared for that conversation because, yeah, I was like, I'm not putting myself in danger.
Yeah, the mules can see. They can go on the outside. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you didn't encounter mules when you were out there solo and have to deal with that. So you mentioned that you were on the Team USA for cycling and you know, you attempted Everest. You've done a bunch of other cool adventures. And I was just wondering, you know, how you felt like those prepared you for doing this FKT solo.
I'll tell you what, I feel like racing with Team USA, I learned how to be an athlete. And one of the things I discovered about myself is I'm a good athlete because I love the process. I love to train. I love to eat healthy. I love to push myself. And I love to then go out and do something to see how all that training and all that commitment pays off. So I think that's really what I learned as a professional athlete. And so when I did the Grand Canyon the first time, the double crossing with the sighted guides in 2018, I think that that was really one of the first times that I had these intentional, conscious thought processes about being brave. And I never really thought about it before then. And so I did the Grand Canyon. When I did the double crossing, that was so hard. I've never done anything like that ever before. I've never done anything that long before. And I realized how brave I was to do that. And it helped me feel more confident. And so then everything I've done, then 2021, I was the first blind person to ride a single road bike across the country following sound, because all I heard as racing tandem bikes is, oh, blind people only ride tandems. You can never ride a single bike. And I'm like, really? Why do you have to say that? So we rode across the country from the West Coast to the East Coast. And it was so hard and it was so dangerous and it was so tiring. And I walked out of that with so much more confidence, right? And then I did Tour Divide on mountain bikes the following year on the Continental Divide. And that, I don't know how I managed to get through that.
That just sounds insane to me.
I have to tell you, that was the hardest, most dangerous thing I've done to date, is doing Tour Divide on single mountain bikes following sound. On that terrain was just unreal. And I developed even more confidence and more bravery and courage. And so when I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about what can I do to say, hey, to this guy who makes this statement, who's very well known, that says blind people will always be tourists because we need guides. And I'm like, what can I do? What could I do that I know that I could try to do alone? And the Grand Canyon obviously was my first choice. And I have to rely on all this confidence that I have built through all the adventures I've done up to this point and believe in myself, and not knowing that I can do it, but knowing that I have enough courage and bravery and confidence in myself to at least take the first step. If I get through the first step, then I'm going to go to the next step. And if I get through that step, I'm going to go to the next step. And just face it. To me, that was the only way that I could face that, was one step at a time.
Yeah, I think that is how you get through all the challenging parts of life, right? You just have to just take that first step and the next step reveals itself.
Mm-hmm.
I think getting over the fear of starting is the hardest part.
Yes. Yes. And you don't think about it too much, because I would start to think about being in the canyon alone, and then I would just feel the fear build inside of me. And I was like, all right, you can't think about that, Sean. you can't think like that.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you lost your sight as an adult. What was your athletic background prior to that? Were you an athlete? Did you engage in sports? What did you do in your sighted life that prepared you for what you're doing now?
I did high school sports, but I come from a very abusive background from my childhood, and I really used sports to get out of the house. It's not that I didn't try, but it wasn't that I was doing the sports because I was trying to be my best self in those moments. It was more of an escape to get out of my home. And then I joined the Army when I was 17. I was a helicopter armament system mechanic, got out of the military, had two kids, had domestic violence was an experience. And so by the time I became a paramedic, I was a single parent. So I didn't diet. I'm not a dieter. I want to be able to eat whatever I want and not have to stress about it. So I was active to not diet, really. I don't know if I would consider myself an athlete. And I knew that when I lost my vision and all I wanted to do was die, because there was no way in my mind I could think of that there was no scenario in my mind of where I was living my best life, a full life, a great life, blind. And so then it became about, I had to redefine myself.
And what led you to choose the life of an athlete? What led you to redefine yourself in that way?
My first thing that I did was run with Team Red, White, and Blue. And it was because my mobility instructor, who teaches me how to use my white cane, drugged me to a running group because I was really, really, really sad and trying to hide and very suicidal. And she drugged me to a group run with Team Red, White, and Blue. And I ran that day 4 miles, tethered to another person who didn't even hesitate to help me. And I never knew that was possible as a blind person. And so it really just started this thought process of curiosity, you know, what is possible? And so I just kind of escalated. I went from running 5Ks, 10Ks, marathons to biathlon. I did cross-country skiing with rifle shooting. And then I got into cycling on a tandem. And I think that the reason why that kind of stuck was someone just made a statement to me that it was 3.5 years before the Paralympic Games. And they're like, well, you've never been a cyclist, so you'll never be good enough. Why don't you just train for Tokyo? That gives you more time. And I didn't know any different because I've never been an athlete like this. I was like, 3.5 years? I got plenty of time. I can totally do this. And so that became my focus. And I went to the Paralympic Games in 2016, and I just built on that.
Yeah. I mean, for myself, at least speaking for myself as an athlete and person who set FKTs, that's always been my driving motivation is the what ifs. You know, you never reach the end of the what ifs. You can reach a goal time, you can do whatever it is you're setting out to do, but you never run out of what ifs. It's like kind of an endless source of motivation.
The what ifs, what is possible? Yeah.
I guess like because you hadn't been an athlete prior, but you had done some sports. What was your biggest surprise or maybe lack thereof of what kind of adaptations it took for you to become an athlete after you lost your vision?
I think the beginning part of getting into training for doing anything from the running to the skiing to the biking was I had to learn how to be uncomfortable. And I was already uncomfortable being blind because I was so scared. Navigating the world, not being able to see. People ask me all the time, like, so eventually you'll just become accustomed to the fear, like you'll get used to it. And I'm like, yeah, there's no getting used to the fear. Things become familiar. And I think for me, becoming familiar with the different levels of fear and emotions that come with doing athletics as a blind person was a process in the beginning. My first experience of understanding, just getting a glimpse that our minds are much more powerful than our bodies was in basic training for the Army. When you're holding a rubber rifle out in front of your body and they're like, one more minute and it burns so bad, you're thinking, I can't hold it up one more second. But you have to change your mentality. You have to think of not the 1 minute, you think of 5 seconds. All right, I did it 5 seconds more. All right, 5 more seconds. All right, 2 more seconds. And then the next thing you know, 30 seconds have gone by. You got 30 seconds left to go, right? You're like, 1 more second. All right, 1 more second, 2 more seconds. All right, 5 more seconds. And it's just this mental process of understanding that even though your body is screaming at you, you can use that mental toughness to be like, yes, you can do it for 5 more seconds. Yes, you could do it for 2 more seconds. And so I think that I just had to learn how to do that in a bigger way, being a blind athlete.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we've mentioned training several times and that you enjoy your training. So can you tell us a little bit about what your training looked like for this Grand Canyon FKT? Like, because it sounds like you hadn't done, well, you need to cross the Grand Canyon before. So in 2018, you said you hadn't hiked before as a blind person. So maybe like, what you did to prepare for that, and then how you continued to amplify those skills to do the FKT in 2024.
So in 2018, I relied heavily on my cardiovascular fitness from cycling. And I did a hike with two of my guides, and we climbed Mount Washington in New Hampshire, I believe. I didn't actually understand we were summiting a mountain that day. I just thought we were hiking.
You're like, this is an awful lot of uphill.
I know. I was, and they're like, we get to the top, and I'm like, I literally just summited a mountain today. I had no idea that's what we were doing. It was so funny. But I felt very proud of myself. But other than that, that was it. For 2024, I have a gym in my garage and I have a sports trainer. And because in areas that I don't know, I need sighted guides. I don't get to go out and hike like someone who can see, who's prepping for a race or an FKT. Can they just go out and they're just on the trails? So I used biking on a trainer as cardio. But I also did a lot of HIIT, and I did a lot of weightlifting, but my weightlifting is like muscular endurance. So I would take 12 exercises and I would block them together, an upper body, a lower body, an ab. And then I'd have four sets of three exercises. And then I would do 100 reps of each. So it was a lot of muscular endurance. And every time I was out hiking or walking with my dog, I was wearing a pack on my back to get used to that. And that was it.
Okay. What did you take with you when you did the crossing in your pack? Obviously you had your food and water. Any other types of gear that you took along?
I had a coat. I had an extra pair of socks. I had three bottles of Coke, one that I drank at Phantom Ranch, and then two for the South Rim climb out because I knew it was going to be hot. And for me, when I'm really hot and tired and stressed, I'm not hungry. So I needed to have something that I could get some sort of sugar from. And then I had a Garmin. I had that little speaker that I use for music. I had a battery. I had a hat. I think that was it. I didn't even take Band-Aids.
So is there anything else that you'd like to share either about your FKT or about what it is you do, or you being a blind athlete? Is there anything else you'd share with our audience today?
Oh, well, one, I am so incredibly grateful that you guys made this happen, because I am very excited for me and for other athletes to find FKTs and do them. And I know other competitive blind and visually impaired, other para athletes. So making this possible for us, I have so much gratitude. So I just want to say thank you so much for making this happen, because I'm not really the person that wants to put it on social media or have an article written about me. And all my blind friends are like, in order for it to be a record, someone needs to do a news article about you. So because now we have this as a resource, this is going to be great. I'm so excited about it. And yeah, if you see a blind person on the trail, read the sign and be nice.
And I'm really grateful to you for reaching out to us and getting the ball rolling on this. I know it's been talked about for a while, so I'm really happy to be able to make the FKT scene more inclusive. So this is a really great thing.
Yeah, I really appreciate you guys so much.
And thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really, really appreciate it. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Sean, for coming on the show. You can read about her FKT on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and follow her adventures on Instagram at Sean_Cheshire.